Support comes from the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center, James Cancer Hospital, and Solove Research Institute. Just as no two people are exactly the same, neither are their cancers. At the OSU CCC James, there is no routine cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you've been working from home since the pandemic, you probably aren't getting as many steps in as you used to, and you might not even notice. Think about it. No more steps from the house to the car to the office. No more walking around the office or lunches out. That means a lot more sitting. Keith Diaz is a certified exercise physiologist and associate professor of behavioral medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. With his colleagues, he has published a study in the Journal of Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise on counteracting the effects of so much sitting. He wrote about the study for The Conversation. We'll post a link to that at WOSU.org/allsides. Keith Diaz, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This sedentary lifestyle issue was a thing even before the pandemic and workplace changes, right?
Yeah, our world has been becoming more and more sedentary for decades. The pandemic didn't start it. It's been happening for quite a while now.
And how does that manifest in overall health among Americans especially?
Well, it manifests in a number of ways, but ultimately people who sit for hours on end, develop many chronic diseases, such as diabetes, heart disease, many types of cancer and dementia. They develop it at much higher rates than people who tend to move throughout their day, and they have a greater risk of dying early.
So that's a correlation. People who sit around a lot during the day probably sit around a lot at night too, is the supposition?
Yeah, it doesn't matter when it happens. Just sitting in itself is harmful and detrimental to your health, whether you do it in the morning, in the evening, during the course of your day.
How did you conduct your study regarding the effects of sitting?
Yeah, so we had people sit in our lab for 8 hours. We did a standard work day. And we had them come on several different days. One of the days we just had them sit and they took just standard bathroom breaks. And then the other days, we tried a couple different strategies to see if we could offset the harms of sitting with light walking. And so on one of the days, we'd have them walk every hour for 1 minute. On another day, they'd walk every half hour for 5 minutes. And we measured their blood sugar levels and their blood pressure during the course of each 8-hour visit.
The study group was, I thought, small, 11 people, right?
Yeah, for these kinds of studies where we controlled everything. So when they ate, how much they ate, how much time it took for them to eat, when they used the bathroom, how much they moved when they moved, et cetera. When you control for all of these factors in a laboratory setting, you don't need large samples to answer these questions because we've isolated. It's the pure effect. And so it is a small sample of 11 people, but not certainly reasonable to answer the questions we were trying to answer in our study.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the effects of sitting too much. You got to sit down every once in a while, but a lot of us are sitting too often. My guest is Keith Diaz. He is a certified exercise physiologist and associate professor of behavioral medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. And he is part of, with his colleagues, published a study recently on the counteracting the effects of so much sitting, and he wrote about it for The Conversation. You can check out the link to that at WOSU.org/allsides. So what did you measure in your subjects to come to these conclusions?
Yeah, we measured their blood sugar levels every 15 minutes with a device called a continuous glucose monitor. It's a patch that just goes on your arm. And we measured their blood pressure every half hour. And we found some really compelling results that we wanted to get out to everybody. And I think the crux of what we found is that if you walked 5 minutes every half hour, you could reduce the blood sugar spike after eating by 60% and reduce your blood pressure by 4 to 5 points.
And that's something that a lot of people aren't doing anymore. Say they're not even walking back from the restaurant they had lunch at or wherever they had it.
Yeah. And I should say the good news is, you know, and myself included, when I found the results of our study, I'm like, I don't know if I could walk every half hour. Like, I don't think my job really allows that. Or I'm just usually involved and engrossed in something. But taking a movement break just for 1 minute every hour still reduced blood pressure by 4 to 5 points. Now, it didn't help with blood sugar, but it at least helped for blood pressure. And so if you're somebody who's saying, like, I can't move every half hour, that's not possible, even less regular breaks was still good to an extent. It didn't offset all the harms, but it reduced some of the harms. And so, you know, I think there's options here about how frequently you can move. Obviously, the best is to move as frequently as possible, but even less frequent breaks still help.
I walk, when I walk at work, my strides are longer. It's more vigorous because the halls are longer, they're wider, they're all this. In my house, even if I got up and walked around, I'm not sure I would do it with the same vigor that I do at work. Is that a thing?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Actually, we had, for our study, this was light walking. It wasn't vigorous. It was 2 miles per hour. So walking a mile in 30 minutes. So most people, I think, would find the pace that we had our participants walk at to be slower than their usual pace. So the answer to the question is, it doesn't really matter how vigorous it is. It was just the act of just moving, getting your muscles contracting and working again is really what this is about. And it doesn't matter if you're sprinting up and down the hall or just doing a casual walk, you still will get health benefits.
It's interesting that there's the school of thought that says that walking is the only thing we really need to be doing. It's what we were built to do. That if we just walked more in general, that's kind of all we would need for exercise. Where do you fall on that?
Well, I think we know that there's decades of research that moderate and vigorous intensity physical activity or exercise is one of the most important health behaviors there is. Right? If we could pack it into a pill, it would be the single most prescribed medication on the planet because of all the health benefits. So there's still doing that rigorous exercise matters. But what I think we're increasingly recognizing is that any movement counts. You may not have the time, will, or desire to do exercise, but if you're just doing movement throughout your day to do your everyday activities, that still matters. That still helps. Do whatever works. Our bodies were made to move, I think, is really the key here is move in any way that you can, because all of it helps and all of it counts.
Does it matter if it's inside or outside?
No, it doesn't matter. You get the health benefits whether you're walking inside, whether you're walking outside. Now, obviously, there's additional benefits to being outside and being out in the sun, getting fresh air. But even indoors, it's still beneficial.
And what about the mental health piece of this?
Yeah, we also studied, when we had our participants sitting for 8 hours in our lab, we asked them throughout the day how they were feeling, what their mood was. And we found that taking those regular movement breaks, those light walking breaks, improved mood, reduced fatigue, and helped our participants feel more energized. And so we think this is a really important message that beyond your physical health, that moving and not sitting for long extended periods of time is good for your mental health in the long term and in the short term.
Are there other kinds of movements besides walking that you're interested in looking at? I guess I'm thinking about stretching. I guess you could do squats. You could do a lot of different things.
Yeah. I think a lot of the studies out there now show it doesn't necessarily have to be walking to offset the harms of sitting. They're called desk calisthenics. But yeah, doing squats, just standing up from your chair and doing some squats and things of that nature, jumping jacks, can offset some of the harms of sitting, right? The key here is that your body needs to move and your muscles need contraction. And the muscles are really important for regulating a lot of things in our body that are important for our health, like your blood sugar. When they're not being contracted, they're not doing the job that they should be doing. And so any movement that gets your muscles stimulated and going is going to benefit and help. So that's really the key is it doesn't necessarily have to be walking, but it has to be something that gets your muscles moving and activated again.
I'm kind of curious if you think we're going to see an uptick in something a couple years from now because of the more sedentary lifestyle so many people have been living.
Yeah. You know, we've seen this historically. We've looked back and see, well, what other events have dramatically changed, you know, our environments, and some of those examples are natural disasters. So we saw Hurricane Katrina, that devastated that New Orleans and that area. And they didn't have access to healthy foods. They didn't have access to gyms because they were all destroyed. And so what you saw was about 5 to 10 years after Hurricane Katrina, there was a huge surge in heart disease and heart disease events and heart disease related mortality. And so that's what we're kind of looking for, expecting to see, is that a surge in a lot of these chronic diseases in a couple of years, because it doesn't happen right away. It'll be just the change in lifestyle that occurs for many years. And so I think down the road, we're expecting to see a surge in a lot of the complications of sitting.
My health app on my watch, I guess I have a goal to stand up once an hour for 12 hours, right, during the day or whatnot. Does the act of even just standing up make a difference?
That's where the scientific evidence is still inconclusive. Standing in itself may not necessarily be any better than sitting, because you're not necessarily contracting your muscles that much and getting your heart pumping. And so that's really the concern. There's some studies that show it's beneficial, but other studies show it actually could be potentially harmful, especially if you're standing for long periods of time. That actually causes blood to pool in your legs and causes changes in your blood pressure levels. And that may not necessarily be a good thing. So my message is always, we know that moving is good for you. So if you can, find a way to move to offset the harms of sitting. The standing desk and just standing, not sure yet whether there is actual substantive benefit.
Okay, standing desk. I wanted to ask you about that. I stand a lot when I'm doing my show. I sit more at my desk, but I stand, you know, I'm for 2 solid hours. I do rock a lot. I'm not just standing statically. I'm moving.
Yeah, and that's the important point, is to prevent that blood pooling in your legs from static standing, is you need muscle contraction. The contraction in the legs is going to send the blood back up to your heart, and that's the key. And so standing with periodic muscle contraction, periodic rocking back and forth or walking will mitigate some of the harmful effects of just standing. So it is about movement. The other thing I usually like to say to people is it's really about the best posture is the next posture. It's switching between sitting and standing, getting some movement in. I think really that's ultimately the ideal kind of day, is just not doing something for long periods of time is really what's going to be most beneficial for your health.
Like sitting on the couch and watching TV?
Yeah. Binge watching Netflix at the end of the day after you have just had a large meal is probably not the best thing to do.
Well, I was going to kind of wonder how you might suss that out, you know, down the road when you look at what the effects of the pandemic have been on people's movements. How do you make the difference between someone who's just sitting at work all day versus the people who maybe don't sit at work all day but come home and they're still binging, because a lot of us got in that habit, right?
Yeah, and that's really been kind of the next where the field is heading, is trying to understand that not all sitting is the same. And sitting on a couch watching TV versus sitting on a computer where I'm mentally and actively engaged, I'm working, or for an older adult, I'm working on a crossword puzzle, or I'm being social. Those are good things. It's good for you to be social. It's good for you to work on crossword puzzles. And those may be different sitting. The effects of harmful sitting are different for those kind of behaviors than it is for you just vegging out, and we'll call it a passive sedentary behavior. Your brain is not activated as much when you're just watching TV. And so there is some emerging evidence to suggest that the passive sedentary behaviors, where you're not actively engaged socially or doing some type of brain cognitive function task, is more harmful than the active sedentary behavior in sitting.
You're testing out strategies to help people who can't walk every half hour or so. Delivery people, truckers, taxi drivers, people that really do sit for a living, right?
Yeah, I think that's really our goal. I think we recognize that there's a lot of people who can't move every half hour, hour. And we want to provide a solution for them to say, like, I'm driving a truck. You know, I can take a break for lunch. If, you know, well, what do I do at my lunch break? Could, if I'd walk for 10 minutes vigorously, would that offset the harms? And so that's what we're trying to do, is try to find different strategies that are going to work for everybody or most everybody, because we realize that walking every half hour is not feasible for a lot of adults.
And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about how much of sitting is sort of a learned behavior. Because I'm thinking of schools that are starting to cut short recesses and stuff like that because they're trying to cram in more information into kids' heads and stuff and all of that. And it's kind of telling them it's okay to be just sitting in a room all day.
Yeah, and that's the problem. It's where did this social norm come from that we're supposed to, our default is sitting? And it starts in the school, right? Prior to kids entering into school, kids are very active. They don't tend to sit still. And so we tend to start to train them when they enter into kindergarten that you're actually supposed to sit for most of your day. You're not supposed to be active and moving around. And that's a learned behavior that persists all the way till they graduate high school. And then if you go to college, it persists in college and then it's penetrated the workplace. So, you know, not to pin it on schools, but you know, I think if we're going to start changing this social norm, it has to start at early ages and stop restricting kids who are naturally inclined to want to get up and move, to allow that to an extent, or allow movement breaks, or allow them to be active in the classroom. I've seen classrooms that have standing desks, they have desk bikes and different apparatus that allows the kid to still get that energy out. And not have to sit. So I think it really does have to start there on some level.
Well, and just as an associate professor of behavioral medicine, I mean, it probably could help with this growing trend of depression and other kinds of mental health issues with young children.
Absolutely. And benefit them academically. We've seen that when you just get a kid to do 20 minutes of light walking through the hallway, that their brain activity spikes tremendously and they perform much better academically when you give them these movement breaks. So it's not just me saying like we should, you know, at the cost of the education of students, get them to move more. There's benefits to this academically that have been shown for decades that kids who move actually have better attention spans, better able to handle complex information and process it and then store it in their memory more long term. So I think there's many benefits to students beyond just the physical health benefits.
Keith Diaz, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Keith Diaz is a certified exercise physiologist and an associate professor of behavioral medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. We've been talking about the benefits of not sitting. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so join us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. When you eat, can play as relevant a role as what you eat when it comes to your weight, your appetite, and your risk for chronic disease. Frank Shear is a professor of medicine and director of the medical chronobiology program in the Division of Sleep and Circadian Disorders at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He's also the senior author of a study published in October that examined how mealtimes can affect our health. Frank Shear, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you, Anne, for having me.
The old adage, eat like a king at breakfast, a prince at lunch, and a pauper at dinner. Is there something to that?
Right. So this is what our grandmothers would have told us. And so what recent studies have shown is that there is actually science behind this. And so our study provides experimental evidence for potential mechanisms that may help explain why this is the case.
Why does the same meal consumed at a different time have a different effect on our metabolism?
So one important factor that one should consider is the role of our internal circadian system, which are the words our body clock. And so it makes it that our body is not really the same in the morning and the evening. And this involves regulation also of metabolism. And so specifically here, we had previously shown that the amount of calories you burn after an identical test meal in the morning and in the evening is not the same. And so you burn more of those calories when you eat the same meal in the morning compared to the evening. And this is true regardless of whether you invert the sleep, wake, and eating fasting cycle. So it's really the circadian system that's a key player here. The other factor, just to add to that, is the regulation of hunger and appetite, where we had previously shown that the circadian system, also independent of our sleep, wake, and eating fasting cycle, modifies our sensation, our feeling of hunger, such that our circadian regulation for hunger is higher in the evening and lower in the morning.
So that means when we eat at night, we get hungry more often?
Well, so this is what we found in the experimental trial we then designed to explicitly test this. And so what we did is we scheduled people to eat 4 hours later, three identical test meals 4 hours later, which is akin to skipping breakfast and then having a late night snack or late night meal. And what we found is that with repeated hourly or two-hourly measures of energy expenditure, so the amount of calories we burn, is that people burn fewer calories when they eat later. And this was also supported by the fact that people had a lower core body temperature. So their set point, it seems, may have been decreased when eating later. And so that's on the side of the use of calories, the burning of calories. At the same time, we also found that those same individuals, and it was a crossover protocol, meaning that each participant was their own control. We also found that they reported more hunger and also appetite, for example, for salty and starchy foods when eating late. And this was supported also by hormone levels, including ghrelin and leptin. So there's ghrelin is a hunger hormone, leptin is a satiety hormone. And so the ratio of those two, when we sampled this hourly across the 24 hours on the highly controlled conditions, also indicated increased objective hunger in these individuals when eating late.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about when you eat and why it matters. My guest is Frank Shear. He's a professor of medicine and the director of the Medical Chronobiology Program in the Division of Sleep and Circadian Disorders at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. What is chronobiology?
That's an excellent question. So chronobiology is really the science about timing in biology. Specifically here, we're talking about circadian, the circadian time frame, which means approximately a day. And the circadian system is coordinated by one central clock we have in the brain, in the hypothalamus, called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. That structure is necessary for the organism to express circadian rhythms, so 24-hour rhythms in physiology and behavior. But in the 90s, it was discovered that that's not the only clock we have. We have clocks in virtually all our organs and tissues. So if you take a heart cell or a fat cell or a skin cell and you place it in a Petri dish, it will oscillate with a rhythm of about 24 hours. And in 2017, the Nobel Prize for Medicine or Biology was awarded for the discovery of the molecular mechanism that underlies this capability of these cells to express circadian rhythms.
When we talk about people who have opposite hours, so that they work perhaps and they work at night, is there any way for them to offset, countervail these genetic survival mechanisms in our body?
Right. Yeah, that is actually quite timely because we published about a year ago a paper in Science Advances. So Dr. Sarah Shalapa was the first author, in which we tested whether meal timing can be used as a countermeasure to prevent the adverse metabolic consequences in simulated night work. And so indeed in night workers, which represent about 15% of the population in the US and in Europe, show an increased risk for many chronic diseases, including obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, depression, even asthma, we recently shown. And so we wanted to know whether meal timing can be used as a countermeasure. So what we did is we had people in the laboratory either in a simulated night work protocol where they ate when they were awake, as most night workers do, or we kept the food timing synchronized to the timing of the central clock, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, regardless of when the people were sleeping and were awake. And we found that when we lock the timing of food to the central circadian clock, the impairments of glucose tolerance could be prevented.
When we talk about the increasing risks for other, you know, for comorbidities, I'm just wondering about how you adjust. I'm in modern times. I mean, maybe it's going to be a couple 12,000 years and things will be different, but a lot of people don't eat a big breakfast nowadays. They tend not to have time to fix the breakfast. Maybe on the weekends they do or something like that. We're more scheduled out. A lot of people eat at 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, you know, that kind of a thing. It doesn't sound good. And there's a lot of other issues that can be associated with that, right?
Right. So especially eating later in the evening is shown to be problematic also from the point of view of glucose control. So we've just discussed factors related to body weight regulation. And by the way, just to say that also those same individuals that ate late in the previous study we discussed also showed changes in their fat tissue that supports fat growth. But in addition to body weight regulation factors, we also see big effects on blood sugar regulation. And so what we have recently published in Diabetes Care, and this was work with Marta Garra-Ouellette and Richa Saxena, is that when people eat 1 hour before their habitual bedtime, compared to the same individuals 4 hours before their habitual bedtime, their blood sugar values go much higher and stay elevated much longer. And the interesting thing is that this is very dependent on the individual, such that if the individuals were carriers of a relatively recently discovered type 2 diabetes risk gene, and this is a gene for melatonin, a melatonin receptor, that the carriers of this risk variant were the ones who were showing the biggest changes, really much bigger than the non-carriers. And this is especially of relevance because this is a very common genetic variant, such that about 50% of the population carries this variant with them, meaning that this is relevant to about half of the population. And so based on this work and also other work where we have looked at the effect of oral intake of melatonin, like over-the-counter melatonin, you can buy it at any pharmacy, on glucose control, we have found that especially those people who are carriers of this risk variant run extra risk when melatonin is high and they're eating.
Okay. Because we usually associate melatonin, a lot of us lay people, with sleep.
Right. And so this is, yeah, please go ahead.
Well, it's interfering with the high melatonin at time. If you're eating late at night, you're also eating when your melatonin's getting ready to put you to sleep, and they're counteracting each other.
Correct. Yeah. So like you say, typically the melatonin would be getting you ready to sleep. Sleep is typically associated with a extended overnight fast duration when people don't consume food or shouldn't consume food. And one line of thought is that it's the melatonin that actually helps by keeping your glucose levels up, even though you are fasting throughout the night, such that your glucose doesn't drop too low. Whereas during the daytime hours, when you are eating, normally melatonin is very low.
If you have to eat later, does it help at all to eat less or to have a salad instead of a steak kind of a thing?
Right, right. Yeah, I think absolutely. So the excursions that you see, so the increases that you see with eating a meal depend heavily on both the size and the composition of the meal. And so especially if you have fast carbohydrates, fast sugars, they cause a big spike. Whereas if you would cut down on carbohydrates, especially the fast carbohydrates, this will be of great benefit to preventing this spike in glucose.
There are other things associated with eating late, and a lot of it's indigestion or digestion related. I mean, it's just a lot of different problems with that, right?
Right. So that's actually a factor that we haven't studied explicitly, but indeed, when you eat close to your bedtime and your body is positioned horizontally, then there may be increased likelihood of reflux. The changes due to sleep as well in your digestion are very likely to be not helpful. So there's many factors related to the importance of food timing and good reasons to stay away from eating too close to your bedtime.
Is it good to eat at the same time every day?
Yeah, excellent question. There is actually not that much, certainly not experimental work that has specifically looked at the regularity of food timing. But association studies do suggest that a more regular food intake pattern is associated with better health outcomes. But this is, at this moment, I would say, is really still hypothesis generating.
Frank Scheer, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Frank Scheer. He's a professor of medicine and director of the medical chronobiology program in the Division of Sleep and Circadian Disorders at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He is senior author of a study that published in October that examined how mealtimes can affect our health. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Food and Drug Administration this week proposed a simplified approach for future COVID-19 vaccination protocols, allowing most adults and children to get a once-a-year shot to protect against the mutating virus. New York Times reporter Apoorva Mandavili covers the coronavirus pandemic and vaccinations. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Describe, you know, kind of the current protocol, what we're in the midst of now.
Well, you know, we have this bivalent booster that the FDA rolled out earlier in the fall. And what that means is it's a booster that has half of a vaccine that's targeted to the variants that were circulating last summer, which is when they decided how to make the vaccine, and then half of the original vaccine that we all got, you know, in 2021 or January. So a lot of people have not gotten it. That's really what we're looking at here is even among 65 plus, which is the high risk group, only about 40% of people have gotten it. And if you look across the whole population, it's a very small percent. It's less than 20% of people have had the booster. So one of the things I think the FDA is trying to do is really simplify things. They want to make it very easy for people to think about this vaccine and not have to deal with, you know, first booster, second booster, third dose, all of those things, and just say, you will get an annual dose of this vaccine, sort of like we get the flu vaccine.
And they've resolved that this could be or will be as effective as the boosters.
Well, that's the big question. A lot of the experts that I talk to are not really sure that this is warranted. They don't feel that the data is quite there yet to make this kind of decision. Everybody's pretty much on board with the idea of regular boosters for high-risk people, you know, older people, immunocompromised people, pregnant women, and babies, you know, who may not have had the chance to get infected yet. But for everybody else who has already had several doses or has been infected multiple times, we all have a lot of immunity. And so these experts that I talk to are not sure that we know quite yet that everybody needs an annual booster.
Does the COVID-19 mutate in the same way? Because I guess a lot of people are thinking of this like, oh, just like the flu shot. But is it the same thing as a flu shot?
It's similar in that the flu also changes all the time, you know, and we make the decision for a flu vaccine in the spring based on sort of what was circulating in the Southern Hemisphere. And then the vaccine is made and it gets rolled out in the fall. Sometimes it's a good match, sometimes it's not. And it's sort of a gamble. And we saw that exact same thing play out with the COVID vaccine because they made the decision last June. And then by the time the vaccines came out in September, the virus had already mutated and it wasn't a great match. So that's one of the things that these experts who will be talking about this tomorrow at the FDA, these advisors to the FDA will be discussing is, are we going to be doing this sort of chasing forever, or are there better strategies maybe that we could be using so that we're not always sort of racing against this virus?
Right. What other strategies do they even conceptualize?
Well, so one possibility is that you go after other parts of the virus. So both of the Pfizer and the Moderna mRNA vaccines target the spike protein, which is the most important part of the virus. But there is an argument for targeting other parts of the virus that mutate less frequently so that you're not, you know, looking at parts of the virus only that are constantly changing. If you get some of these more conserved parts of the virus, that maybe you would get a more reliable immune response. You might also be able to go after immune cells. We, you know, right now the vaccines, we sort of really look at how well they raise antibodies, but there are a lot of scientists who think that the reason we have continuing protection against severe disease, even when we keep getting infected, is because of immune cells called, you know, T cells. And so there's some idea that maybe we should be making vaccines that enhance that response instead of only thinking about antibodies.
Right. The spike protein is the things that make the virus stick to us.
Exactly.
It's kind of a nice visual sort of a thing. And that is what the virus has been getting better at, is transmitting and sticking.
That's correct. So, you know, within reason, because the spike protein has to attach to human cells, there's only so much it can change. If it changes too much, it won't be able to attach to human cells anymore. But it has been changing quite a bit. And over time, we've seen it's gotten more and more contagious. Every single variant now has been more contagious than the previous one. And the latest one that we've been seeing, XBB.1.5, is also immune evasive, meaning it can get around the immunity we have from vaccines and from infection pretty well. And so those two things have made it pretty a pretty big enemy for us.
What's the sense about what we've learned over the last couple of years about what to expect in the coming years? I mean, what does the way this, because it's a novel virus, it's new. We've never had it before. It's sometimes we have to remind ourselves of that, that that's why this has been a problem. There's a lot more to come. Maybe it's going to settle down. Is there any indications for that?
I think this year is probably the first sort of indication of what we might see, which is there will be a lot of infections and there will be some hospitalizations, mainly of high risk people, and the rest of us will get infected and maybe have to stay home again, sort of like the flu. You know, the scientists that I've talked to are hoping that this is sort of a seasonal pattern, that like the flu, it'll be mostly in the fall and winter. But, you know, it's unclear because as we've seen, the virus has come back at other times, like Delta was in the summer, and we've seen, waves in the spring, and sometimes it comes back in the south more because that's when people are indoors in the south. And so it's not fully settled yet. We don't know everything about this virus. As you said, it's new. We're learning, but it seems at least clear that we probably will have waves every winter.
Is this kind of a dumb question, but I don't know if I've ever asked it before. Is the flu seasonal because of human behavior and therefore the COVID-19 is season or could be seasonal as well, more about our behavior than about the virus itself?
It's both. And the virus also survives better at certain temperatures and certain humidity. So that's why, you know, we see it sort of in the spring and in the southern hemisphere, and then we see it here in the fall. So there's that. But there's no question that when people are indoors with windows closed and congregating, you know, not outdoors, that is when the virus has the most chances to spread. So it's a combination of both of those things.
And you said that this will take into account individual needs, people who have age, older, younger, that kind of a thing.
Correct. So the FDA also is actually taking that into account. And what they're proposing is that high-risk people, so older people, immunocompromised people, babies get two doses every year, and that everybody else get one dose. And I think one of the things that'll be discussed tomorrow at this meeting is, does everybody else even need that one dose, or should we be talking about two doses for high-risk people and zero for everybody else?
Huh, why is that?
Well, so far we're seeing that the doses that people have gotten have held up really well against the virus, even when the virus has been changing quite a lot. When we see hospitalizations, they're mostly of people who are over 70 or even over 75. We are not seeing hospitalizations in younger people who have had previous doses, previous infections. And so it looks like even as much as the virus is changing, we're not really at risk of seeing the kinds of hospitalizations and deaths that we saw, you know, earlier on in the pandemic. So there are a lot of scientists who think, you know, we shouldn't be giving vaccines to the entire population if they don't actually need it. And there's some downside to that. There's the issue of sort of immune imprinting. If you know how ducks sort of imprint on the first thing they see as the mother. It's sort of like that. So in immune imprinting, your body sort of recognizes the first version of the virus that you see. And so it just keeps recalling that same immune response preferentially, even when you're changing the vaccine.
Can you give me an example of how that manifests?
So in this bivalent vaccine, for example, they're using half and half, right? They're using half of this vaccine is for the original virus and half is for the newest variant. And what's been happening there is that the vaccine is provoking an immune response to that half that's for the original virus. And so even if you have this other half that's supposed to be for the newer variant, your body is just not really working very hard to fight against that. And so it's been a sort of losing battle from the beginning to have this half and half business. And one of the things that the experts are saying is, why are we even doing that? Why not just have the vaccine be only for the newest variants? Why are we even bothering with the original version? And I think that's one of the questions that will be asked tomorrow.
When we talk about things that the virus is carrying outside of the spike protein issue, what are some things that they might target in the virus besides the protein that attaches it?
There is another protein called the nucleocapsid, which we know is also immunogenic, meaning that the body will raise antibodies to it. So that would be a very good target. There are particular parts of spike that we've known are very important for raising antibodies, but there are other parts of spike that are really important for these immune cells that I mentioned earlier for raising a T cell response. And so there, the idea would be to sort of emphasize those parts instead of only the part of the spike that is good for antibodies.
I know you cover global health as well. Is there any sense about how this plays out around the world? I'm thinking of in particularly in developing places where they're already way beyond, you know, way behind as far as addressing the vaccination schedule.
Yeah, I mean, there are countries where people have yet to receive a single dose right. of the vaccine, let alone 3, 4, 5. You know, in a lot of places, people have just lost interest in the vaccine because a lot of people have been infected. And like we have seen here, they are seeing that being infected also confers immunity, and it seems to protect them fairly well from severe disease. And so it's become, in a lot of countries where there are a lot of other viruses to worry about, a lot of other diseases to worry about, you know, when you've got Ebola going around and Lassa fever going around, you don't have a lot of time to think about a disease that maybe isn't so fatal anymore. And so it's just sort of faded into the background for a lot of health ministries.
The federal government announced a few weeks ago that they'll no longer be funding the production of the COVID-19 vaccine, and that production will be commercialized. Let's talk about that and how that looks going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think what that means is these companies that have already made hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah, it's not like they've been giving it away for free. The government's been paying them. Yeah,
exactly. But the government's been paying them about $30 a dose. And what this looks like now is that insurance companies are going to have to pick up the cost, and the doses are probably going to cost about $100 to $150. And so that means it may be out of reach for some people who are not insured or who, you know, can't afford, their insurance doesn't cover it and they can't afford it. It may be that it becomes like the flu vaccine where employers pay for it and you might be able to go get it at a pharmacy and there are, you know, health programs that allow you to get it for free. But we'll have to wait and see exactly how it all plays out. But it does mean that it's going to be a lot more expensive than it has been.
Why?
Well, this is one of those excellent questions. If you ask the companies, they'll say it's because it costs a lot of money to make these vaccines, et cetera. But if you ask some of the experts I talk to, they will say that companies are just trying to make a very big profit.
Yeah, because the technology has something that's been in the works for 15, 20 years. It's not like they just discovered the technology to produce these, you know, overnight after the pandemic. That's why a lot of people were so surprised at the time that they did come out with the vaccine so quickly. But that's because...
Right. The technology had been worked on for 20 years. But also, you know, they've been working on these particular vaccines for the last 3 years. And, you know, they've said over and over that one of the beauties of this vaccine is that you can tweak just a little bit of it for whatever new variant. That also means that it is fairly simple. And so it's not exactly clear why they would need to charge quite so much.
And is there any sense that you're getting from the insurance industry about how they'll cover it? I mean, they're going to have to cover it if you have insurance. It'll be a part of what's required?
It will be a part of what's required. But again, I think a lot will depend on how the FDA advisors talk about it tomorrow. If, you know, if the FDA says everybody should get it, that'll be a very different picture than, let's say, if they decide only high-risk people should get it, and then the insurance companies may cover it only for them, and anybody else who wants it is going to have to pay out of pocket. So I think a lot will depend on, you know, where the guidance from the FDA and the CDC end up.
Where are we at the death rate of this? It's gone down a lot, but it's still pretty high, isn't it?
It's gone down actually quite a bit. It's way less than 1% now. It used to be something like 3%, but it's really now, the death rate is incredibly variable depending on age. So if you look at older people, it's a lot higher than it is for, you know, young people. It's in the sort of 0.01 sort of range for some age groups. And so it really varies based on where you live, who you are, how many doses of vaccine you've had, how old you are, what other conditions you have. But for the vast majority, the death rate has dropped very, very significantly.
And Apoorva, how are you keeping track of how much who and how they're studying this virus?
Well, the CDC has a lot of ongoing epidemiological studies. They collect data from hospitals. They collect data from, you know, even the companies There are a lot of independent academic groups that are tracking some of this. And so they have a lot of different sources of information that they can go to figure out what's actually going on the ground.
Apoorva Mandivali, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much. It's my pleasure.
Apoorva Mandivali is a reporter for The New York Times. She focuses on science and global health. And we've been talking about new protocols, perchance, from the Food and Drug Administration for the future COVID-19 vaccinations. That's it for now. Thanks so much for listening today. This has been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.